before I have to go. And like I said in the email this morning, I'll add time next week for those who are able to stay after 11 to ensure that that we address our final topics for the series. I don't have the option to extend for June 30th. So that's what we'll do for now. And I do expect to revisit this theme at some point because there's so much to do in general in learning Sephardic history and some of the figures. Like we're doing a series on giants of Sephardic Jewry, and we're not even talking about Maimonides directly. You know, I mean, what kind of giants of Sephardic Jewry is it when you don't talk about Maimonides? So there is a lot more that we definitely need to talk about. But let's get started. Last week, we talked about Ramban, Nachmanides, introducing him somewhat. We described a little bit of the world of Jewry in Christian Spain in the 13th century before we went into his biography. We talked about his scholarship, his background in medicine, his background in philosophy. And we gave a bit of a biography of the ups and downs of his life in the province of Aragon, leading ultimately to his expulsion after the disputation, which we're going to talk about today, and his travels to Israel, his life in Jerusalem. All of that was from last week. And thank you, Marlene, for the mazel tov in the chat, and mazel tov to you on your grandson's graduation as well that night. Okay, so we started to talk about Nachmanides, Ramban, as a political leader within the community, and we mentioned some of the back and forth that went on involving the Al-Constantini family, which was also a bit of a player, although he doesn't seem to think they were. And that brings us to greater discussion of what could be called the Maimonidean controversy. Big words, we'll explain. I will note that this class is dedicated in memory of Yedda Grisman, Yedda Bat Yechezkel Zichrona Levracha, by Rabbi and Lori Grisman. It's Rabbi Grisman's mother and mother-in-law, her yahrzeit is today, and also will dedicate learning in memory of Peter Salmon, Zev Yisrael ben Avram, Zichrona Levracha. So, the Maimonidean controversy, almost the words sound boring, but it's not, as we'll see. Maimonidean, obviously from Maimonides, Rambam. Maimonides was the giant in the world of Judaism, forget Sephardic Judaism, Judaism in general. In this period, frankly, it remains so in large measure to this day, a giant in terms of his writing in Jewish law, in Jewish philosophy, in so much more, political involvement. There's everything when you're talking about him. Well, his philosophy sparked major controversy. A lot about him sparked controversy, but we're talking about his philosophy. Maimonides was willing, in particular, to interpret biblical text in non-literal ways when the literal read conflicted with his philosophical ideas. In other words, he had certain ideas about God, about the world, about Torah, and if he saw something in the biblical text that didn't fit, then he said, okay, clearly we misunderstand the text. You have to read it in a different way. Simple and common example. Maimonides argued that God cannot possibly be physical. Because if God is physical, then anything that's physical, based on the ideas that go back to the Greeks, number one, deteriorates, and number two, can be divided, and God is one, and God is eternal. So that can't be. So all the times in the Bible when you see God's great arm and things like that, obviously that's not really describing a physical form. Now to us, we take that sort of as a given, that God isn't physical. In his day, there were those who indeed argued against him because of that. Maimonides was also heavily intellectual. He believed that the goal of the human being is to achieve intellectual closeness to God, comprehension of God. Take a look at source number one, and you'll see an outgrowth of that. His description of what life in the next world and the ultimate resurrection of the dead is going to look like. I just put the link in the chat again for the source sheet. He says, spiritual entities, meaning purely spiritual. He doesn't mean a person who is a spiritual person. He means like angels. That's what we're talking about. We'll talk about angels in a little bit also. He says, spiritual entities do not have physical pleasure and do not comprehend it. They lack our senses with which to experience what we experience. One of us who would be purified and would reach that status posthumously would also cease to experience physical pleasure and would not desire it. This would be like a great emperor wishing to lose his throne and return to playing with a ball in the street. He says, if a person after leaving this world becomes purely spiritual, they're not interested in what Rambam called, because he wasn't a Yiddish speaker, Narishkeit. That would not have interested Maimonides. And he says, that's not what people do after they're gone. At some point, he certainly did prefer the ball game over an empire. When the emperor was a child, so he wanted to play ball when he was young and foolish, just as we prefer physical pleasure over the spiritual. So Maimonides says that when you talk about the ultimate resurrection of the dead, and we learned about this a couple of years ago at Beth Emeth, back when we used to learn in person, we talked about that and where it's anchored in Tanakh and all of that. Maimonides said, even though there are verses that seem to describe that, and Talmudic passages which seem to describe that as a world in which there is physical perfection and physical pleasure, he said, you can't take that literally. You have to reinterpret it. It has to be purely spiritual, because there's no reason for anybody who has left this world to want a physical existence anymore. Believe it or not, eating is not going to be a thing anymore. So he says. Similarly, it's hard to be skinny or not skinny when there's no body. You know, we could think of ourselves that way. We could think of ourselves now that way. In another vein, Maimonides is of the belief that spiritual things are completely separate and distant from physical things. You can't link the two at all. Seen a little bit in what we saw in source number one. And therefore, he says, human beings outside of the realm of prophecy never interact with what are called in Hebrew malachim, angels. If an angel is a truly spiritual being, and you'll see Maimonides doesn't believe it always is, but if it is, human beings don't normally have interaction with them. And therefore, numerous stories that are found in Chumash, in the Bible, that depict human beings having conversations with angels, and certainly with groups, he says that's just a prophecy. That's not something that's actually happening in a real conversation. It's a vision that's happening. So, for example, Abraham welcomes the three guests at his tent. That's a dream sequence. That's not happening live, as far as Maimonides is concerned. Now, Mariana, yes. You're muted. Mariana, you're muted. I can't hear you. Oh no, they got it from us, like a lot of their best ideas. Angels are found in Tanakh. Yeah, absolutely, from the beginning to the end. Now, we're going to talk more about what they are in a little bit. It's not going to be our main focus today, but we are going to have to come back to it. But absolutely, no, the angels are found in Tanakh. They're found in the Chumash. So with this willingness that Maimonides has to reinterpret text in order to fit his philosophy scared a lot of people. Because, boy, what you can do with that, the sky's the limit. If at that point you're able to reinterpret and re-explain, that offers some pretty liberal approaches to the text of the Torah. He also had a general rationalist bent. You see it when he tries to explain the lessons of mitzvot, and he calls them reasons for mitzvot. Yeah, we can explain why there's a law like keeping kosher. Sure we can. Well, that, you know, opens up the possibility for people to say, well, if I know what the reason is for a mitzvah, then I'm also able to offer, you know, well, maybe that shouldn't be relevant in this circumstance. Maybe it's no longer something that we have to practice. Maimonides rejects mysticism, even where it appears in the Torah, like ideas of magic and sorcery. Even though there are those who have read a certain type of mysticism into Maimonides' writings, he's definitely not a magic person. He, even though the Torah prohibits use of magic, he says, yeah, because magic, believing in that kind of thing, leads you to believe in idolatry. But he doesn't think that it's actually substantive in any way, even though we find magic were discussed in the Torah. And to go back towards the Malachim, and then Rebecca, I see your hand. Going back towards the discussion of the Malachim that we talked about, these angels, Maimonides believes that there are spiritual Malachim, like they exist. There are spiritual angels. However, he says not every time that the Torah refers to an angel is it a spiritual being. He says Malach just means something God uses to carry out a task. He says a raindrop is a malach because God wants the grass to grow. He sends the rain, the grass grows. So the rain is a malach. And yes, logically, someone will be asking this question in their head. A human being can be characterized as a malach. It is an agent of what God wants to have happen. Rebecca. So definitely, right, definitely part of the problem, and certainly later in history, like centuries later, this is alleged against him, is that he was very comfortable quoting Greek ideas and Arab ideas. He quotes Aristotle verbatim in you know, commentary to Pirkei Avot, for example. He quotes Arab thinkers in his day. And to add to this, Maimonides' followers were often very liberal in their approach to Judaism and to Torah. So he was blamed for the fact that they were not necessarily so careful or so traditional in their approach to Torah. Mariana, you're muted. You have to unmute. Sorry, I keep remuting people because I hear background noise, so you have to unmute yourself.
Would you say they hear the science?
So there's definitely scientific thinking there. I think you had stepped away, but he had a rationalist bent that emerges in everything in Maimonides.
Black and white.
Yeah, I wouldn't say black and white. No, that I would not say. There's nuance. But the first generation of opposition to Maimonides came in his own lifetime. But our focus is on the next generation. The authors of the Tosfot, we talked about them a little bit last time, you're now talking about in the early 13th century, they responded to what they saw as people straying from Torah by banning the writings of Maimonides because people were quoting him as their support for what they were doing. Well, there was a counter ban by those who supported Maimonides, like the Al-Constantini family we talked about last week. And both sides turned to Nachmanides in Spain. Nachmanides was such an intellectual giant, and he was proficient in philosophy, but staunchly traditional, that everybody turns to him, and he's relatively young at this stage, right? We said that that Nachmanides was born in, what, 1190-something? 1194, he is all of 40 years old when this is happening, and the Jewish world turns to him to address it. So, yes, Rose.
I just want to make a comment that it's not surprising that he was like that, because he was number one opposition. He wrote the treatise on Esma.
There's a lot to be said about this. It's certainly true. So Nachmanides takes a two-prong approach. He, on the one hand, writes a letter to the Jewish communities of Aragon, Navarre, Castile, urging them to bring people back to tradition. On the other hand, he writes a second letter to the Tosafists, the rabbis in France, who are excommunicating people who study Maimonides, and he defends the writings of Maimonides. And he argues for unity. He says, you know, issuing excommunications is going to split the Jewish people. Newsflash. He says further, Maimonides' writings are needed. He says, it may be that from your perspective, you're not bothered by the philosophical questions that other people are bothered by. But a lot of people are finding answers to their questions in the writing of Maimonides. Better to find a way to keep them in the fold, and they'll be the ones who will read Guide of the Perplexed from Maimonides. Well, Nachmanides lost this battle. Despite his best efforts, there were the bans, there were the counter-bans, and what ends up happening is that those who are anti-Maimonides went to the Dominican priests. The Dominican order was created in order to enforce decrees of the church at a time when various political governments were not interested in enforcing those decrees. So those who opposed Maimonides went to the Dominican priests and told them that there's stuff in Maimonides which they would find to be heretical to Christianity, anti-Christian, which is certainly true because, you know, he was talking about Judaism. And so the result of that is the burning of texts of Maimonides by the church, number one. And the story goes that this also leads to the public burning of the Talmud in Paris in the year 1240. We discussed this last July when we had our series on the history of Jewish publishing. And I brought you in source number two an excerpt from a paper we looked at that time from Dr. Sadia Eisenberg, Reading Medieval Religious Disputation. He points out that there really isn't evidence to support the idea that this led to the burning of the Talmud in 1240. The point stands, which is, number one, it was a terrible time of controversy. Number two, the Jewish world turned to Nachmanides to try to solve it. Unfortunately, he did not succeed. That brings me to a case where he did succeed. And we discussed this briefly last week, but now we're going to talk about it for real. And that is the disputation in the year 1263. Yes, Susan. Yes.
But, so those who were attacking him were also then doing something just as bad.
You know that things are always wrong until they're necessary in order to serve what I believe is a more important mission. Then they become right. That's human nature. Welcome. That's the way we function. So you are 100% right that the idea of turning this over to the secular authorities should have been anathema, and yet it happened. I'm just going to ask in general. Sorry, Susan's question was a fine question to ask, and this following is not about Susan's question at all. But I'm going to say in general, I'm going to ask if we could keep it to questions as opposed to comments, just because we're going to run out of time, because as you know from my email this morning, I have to leave early. So your question was fine, Susan. It wasn't about you. No. Yeah. True. Yes. Mariana, you have a question?
What does manatees mean? You keep saying the word manatees.
No manatees. They're down in Florida. No, Maimonides. Rambam. Rabbi Moses.
But there is another word.
Nachmanides. Huh? Nachmanides. Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman.
Okay.
Ramban. Yeah, I keep going back and forth in what I call him, because when I say Ramban, some people don't realize that that's different from Rambam. Rambam is Maimonides. Ramban is Nachmanides.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the disputation. The year 1263. The place is Barcelona, which is part of Aragon, ruled by James I. In order to explain the disputation, we need to go back in time. In general, in the high and late Middle Ages, so you're talking about 11th century to about the 15th century, the church tried many tactics to convert Jews. One of the main branches that they tried was intellectual. They had forced sermons, right? The forced sermon is not what everybody had to sit through before COVID. The forced sermon is where they actually compelled the Jews to go to the church and hear the local priest, friar, whoever it was, lecture them about the glories of Christianity and how wrongheaded Judaism is. There was censorship of Jewish texts that were viewed as anti-Christian. We talked about that last summer in our series. And there were public disputations, which were meant to demonstrate the superiority of Christian positions. Now, Jews had plenty to say in response, right? If you go back to Shmuel HaNagid, who we talked about, and his issues with Ibn Khazm about Islam. But Jews generally tried to avoid engaging in these public disputes, knowing that if the church wanted, they could punish the Jew who debated and say, well, you're a heretic, and they could take out their wrath on the Jewish population as well. In other words, you lose. Whether you win or you lose, you lose. That's the way it works. So that brings us to Nachmanides being compelled to engage in a disputation in the year 1263. There was a Dominican monk by the name, or friar, I don't know the difference between a friar and a monk, but his name was Pablo Cristiani. He was a convert from Judaism. And he claimed that he could prove that the core texts of Judaism, Tanakh and Talmud, predict and support Christianity. That was his argument. The church leans on James of Aragon to set up the debate, so that they'll be able to use it as a tool to get the Jews to convert. Meaning the debate goes on, the church emerges saying, look, we won, see that? We beat the Jewish champion. And then they go on to get Jews to convert. Well, Nachmanides participates only when he is promised that he will not be prosecuted for his words. If you take a look on the source sheet, and I put the link in the chat a few times, at source number 3, the beginning of source number 3, we have the text of the debate as published by the church, and we have the text of the debate as published by Nachmanides. You'll be shocked to know their accounts are not the same. So if you look at the beginning of number 3, and I gave you a web link you can click on to get the text, Stanford had it online. They pulled the page down when they reorganized their site, and I don't know where it is now. However, the beauty of archive.org is that you can still find it online. So, our Lord the King, this is Nachmanides speaking, our Lord the King commanded me to dispute with Friar Paul in his palace before him and his advisors in Barcelona. I replied, I will do as the King commands if you permit me to speak freely. I hereby request the permission of the King and the permission of Friar Raymond of Penaforte and his associates who are here. Friar Raymond of Penaforte replied, so long as you do not utter blasphemies. I said to them, I wish to observe your law in this regard, but I also wish to speak freely in debate, as you speak freely. I have the wisdom to speak properly in debate as you indicate, but it must be according to my will. They all gave me permission to speak freely. So he records, they told me I can say whatever I think is appropriate to say. So the debate proceeds. And as promised, Pablo argues Christianity was predicted by Tanakh and by the Talmud, and therefore Jews should accept it. I brought you one argument as an example of it. This goes back to something we saw with Shmuel HaNagid. Do you remember one of the examples I brought of Shmuel HaNagid versus Ibn Khazm was that Ibn Khazm said, your Torah is false. It says the scepter will never leave Judah, and you don't have any kings coming from the tribe of Judah. You live under Islam. Clearly your Torah is false. So this point that you could beat the Jews by just pointing out that they are now subservient to Islam and to Christianity is one that everybody liked to bring against us in different ways. You may be familiar with the book, The Kuzari, on Jewish philosophy, where the subtitle is always given as In Defense of the Despised Faith. That's the way they looked at us. That was the way they portrayed us. Well, here, Christiani uses the same argument, not the same way Ibn Khazm did, but toward a different point. If you take a look back in source number 3, he began, we're in the second paragraph in source number 3, he, Christiani, began, "Behold, scriptures say, the scepter shall not pass from Judah, nor the staff from his descendants, until Shiloh comes," meaning the Messiah. "Thus the prophet says that Judah shall have power forever until the coming of the Messiah who will descend from Judah. Thus today, when you Jews have neither scepter nor staff, the Messiah has already come. He is of the seed of Judah, and his is the power." In other words, the argument that the church puts forth is that the scepter shall not leave Judah until the Messiah comes. Well, the end of the Second Temple, you stopped having kings. Must be that that's when the Messiah came. Now, you may recall, the Second Temple is destroyed in the year 68 or the year 70, Common Era. So their argument is that that is the time of the rise of Christianity, which tells us that that the Torah is validating Christianity as the replacement for Judaism. Well, Nachmanides isn't so impressed. I think he might have heard that one before. He says, "I responded and said, it was not the prophet's intention to say that the rule of Judah would never be suspended. Rather, he said it would not pass away and be annulled completely. This means that so long as there be a monarchy in Israel, it should belong to Judah." The statement that the Torah was making was, if there will be Jewish kings, it should be from the tribe of Judah. Now, that's actually a discussion. Those who learned the Book of Samuel with me will recall, because King Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. But that's not our discussion right now. He says, if because of their sins it should be suspended, if we lose the monarchy, it would ultimately return to Judah. And that's his argument, which he goes on to point out. After all, we had a period of exile in Babylon when we didn't have a king also, and then monarchy came back to Judah. And he says there was a period of time when there were even priests from the Hasmoneans, and that was considered wrong that they ruled for that time because it's supposed to really be from Judah. In general, Nachmanides, Ramban, responds to the Christian attempt to co-opt Judaism by arguing that you guys really don't understand the Torah, and you guys are also out of touch with reality. So, for example, he said, there are no such predictions of Christianity in the Torah. Whatever you think is a prediction, it's not a prediction. He says the Torah is often meant to be understood allegorically. The Talmud is often to be understood allegorically. So, for example, there's a passage in which they describe the Messiah being born when the temple was destroyed. So, again, temple's destroyed in the year 68, so they say, oh, well, that's roughly the time that the Messiah is born. So they use that to say, look, the rabbis predicted. He says, no, that wasn't their point. The point is to say that God plants the seeds of our redemption even at the time of destruction. That's all it's about. It's not predicting Christianity. And he said, you guys are out of touch with reality. You claim you're living in a messianic time now, the 13th century. He says, you guys are awfully bloody for people who are living as a post-messianic population. Isn't there this thing about no more war and all of that? Like, you think this is a messianic time? That was another of his arguments. Mariana. You have to unmute. I don't understand your question.
Well, they are not talking about any woman's rights or what the woman say.
In the debate, in the disputation?
Huh?
In the disputation?
Disputation.
Again, this is the debate about proving the validity of Judaism versus Christianity.
So far, nobody mentioned about women. They are an important part of society.
Yeah, but that's not what they're interested in doing. They're interested in proving to to Jews.
But that's
that wasn't the church's agenda. It just wasn't. So, what happened? Well, the disputation was disbanded out of fear of attacks, hang on Claudette, out of fear of attacks by zealots who were not happy that Nachmanides was doing so well in the debate. The Jews were allowed to stay as Jews in Aragon. The church wrote up their account. Nachmanides wrote up his account, which is generally considered the more credible version of the debate. But Nachmanides suffers for his success because, yes, he was promised he wouldn't be prosecuted, and therefore he's not exiled. However, when his manuscript is published, the church says that wasn't protected. There was a non-disclosure agreement. He wasn't supposed to do that. The only official account of the debate should be what we say happened in the debate. And the result is he's expelled, and he ends up going to Israel, as we discussed last week. Claudette. Yeah, and there's a lot out there. There's also a popular movie that was made about it.
You just have to put
it's fiction.
But...
okay, thank you. So let's talk about Nachmanides' ideas. I gave you in source number 4 on the sheet a list of some of his writings, kind of a highlights list, if you will. He wrote the letter of Nachmanides, Igeret Haramban, which I used in the beginning of our discussion of him last week. Remember, I told you about the fellow at the blood drive. So it shows his approach of piety, of simplicity, of asceticism. He was a believer in avoiding, physical indulgence, humble inside and out. That's really his personality, which emerges in the letter of Nachmanides. And again, if you look back at last week's sheet, I gave you a link. You can find the translation of it online. He also wrote a commentary to the Talmud, which was very, very important because he led the Spanish school of Talmud commentary. Those who are familiar with Talmudic study may be familiar with the Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov Elasvili, the Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim, the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, the Ra'ah. These are all of the school developed by him, by Nachmanides, of his students in Spain. They're heavily influenced by his commentary to the Talmud. I went out of order in my list here, sorry. Torat HaAdam, the Torah of Man, is a work primarily of law, laws of illness and treating illness on Shabbat and issues like that, visiting the sick, death, as well as avelut, as well as mourning. And that's a work that is studied and used to this day. Yes, he did. He also wrote a work, Milchamot Hashem, The Wars of the Lord. The Wars of the Lord as the translation of it. And as I wrote on the sheet, it's a commentary defending a major legal work of Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi of Fez in Morocco. I'm not going to really go into this one right now, but it was also very important. He also wrote a commentary to Maimonides' Book of Mitzvot. Maimonides wrote a book. We've discussed on other occasions. It was a big sport back in the Middle Ages. There's a line in the Talmud which says that there are 613 commandments, 613 mitzvot. So the question is, how do you get to 613? Because if you just start counting in the Torah, you'll end up with way more than 613. So the question is, what exactly is included, what is not included, and it has ramifications in terms of how Jewish law develops. So at this point in history, during the Middle Ages, a lot of different great thinkers are dedicating serious time to coming up with the list. Maimonides has his list. Nachmanides comes up with his own list, in which he thinks Maimonides left some things off that belong on. He has some things that don't belong that are there. So as an example, Maimonides in his list of the mitzvot does not include aliyah, moving to Israel. He doesn't say that living in Israel is a mitzvah. Nachmanides believed that was a mistake. Another example, Maimonides believes that there is a daily mitzvah of prayer. You have to pray to God daily. Nachmanides says there's no such biblical commandment, only that you should believe that when you cry out to God, God will help, and at a time of need, you call out to God, but not that there's a daily biblical obligation of prayer. So they're pretty substantive debates. These aren't only esoteric issues. He also wrote a commentary to the Torah, to the Chumash. And that becomes very, very important. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this. This was the last work written by Nachmanides. He already was in Israel at this point, living in Akko. He spends a lot of his time there focusing on language, word choice, grammar, context, but he also deals with Midrash, and he also veers at times into Sod, into mysticism. And in his introduction, I brought it for you in source number 5 on the sheet. Quite a bit of his work is translated into English, Paul, for your note in the chat. Rabbi Shavel, I believe, did a lot of translation of it, C-H-A-V-E-L. If you look up Shavel and Nachmanides, you'll be able to find things. But take a look at source number 5, please. He wrote in his introduction, "I will place as illumination before me the lights of the pure candelabra, the commentary of Rabbeinu Shlomo." Rabbeinu Shlomo is Rashi. "The desirable crown and splendid diadem crowned in the logic of scripture, Mishnah, and Gemara. His is the lot of the firstborn." He's got Midrash, he's got Talmud. "In his words I will speak, and in their love I will be foolish, and with them we will engage in give and take, analysis and examination, in his simple explanations and analysis, and in every story in its form as mentioned in his commentary." He's waxing a little poetic here. Remember, he's the Spanish school. That's like their hallmark. They, when he says, "In their love I will be foolish," he's borrowing a biblical phrase, I should say. It doesn't mean foolish like a fool. It means to be just besotted with love. That's really what he's saying. And then he goes on to say, at the same time, with Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, who is much more the rationalist, the grammarian, "we will have open rebuke and hidden love." Meaning, I'm going to disagree with him all the time, but really, I love him. I love Ibn Ezra. Really. I'm just going to disagree with him. But he's not afraid to challenge anyone, including Rashi. He will provide different views, but he honors those who preceded him, even as he charts his own path. Mariana. No, Rashi was French. French, and he studied in Germany, and then went back to France.
So how did these people make a living? They prayed all day.
Who said that? Rashi had income probably from being a vintner. There's some debate historically. He displays a lot of knowledge of wine and the winemaking process, and it is thought that he actually had a vineyard. So, Maimonides was a physician, you know. Nachmanides may have been a physician as well, but he also comes from a wealthy family, which helps. Susan.
I'm more interested in the grammar. You said wasn't grammar relatively new in Russia? I know he's after Russia. But wasn't the applying of grammar to explanations relatively new? How did the grammar occur?
So no, first of all, grammar is just language. You know, whether we identify it as a separate study and write books, it's just language. But no, the idea of looking at grammatical roots, while not structured the same way as it is today, goes back to Talmudic times. Often their analyses of text are based on problems where something doesn't fit grammatical form as it would be expected to. As far as I know, in terms of works of grammar that are actually written as standalone Hebrew grammars by rabbis, I think that starts in the 9th century, but I'm not 100% sure. So I'm not going into specifics of that, especially as I just looked at the clock and it's 10:39 and I'm going to have to go to the funeral shortly. So I want to make sure to at least finish Nachmanides, even if we don't start a Barbanel today. So at this point, I'm motoring. I apologize. I brought you source number 6 because I thought it was worth seeing. You'll take a look at it later, but it just shows you Nachmanides bringing Greek science, which he's willing to accept. He's talking about the question of how God could have made the rainbow after the flood, if rainbows are built into nature. And he says that's not what it means. Rainbows always existed. What God did was he pointed to a rainbow and said, see, that's a sign that I'm not going to flood the world again. But he says it based on the science of his day. We see it in other ways as well, but I'm gonna pass on that right now. The last of his writings that I wanted to take a minute on is his Sha'ar HaGemul. Sha'ar HaGemul, I called it in source number 4, The Gate of Reward. It's actually the end of the earlier mentioned book, Torat HaAdam, the Torah of Man. And it's about theodicy. It's about why bad things happen to good people. He disagrees with Maimonides about what Messiah's time is going to be like. Maimonides said there really aren't miracles in the time of the Messiah. And Nachmanides says, of course there are. It's a period of great miracles. And many of his ideas had special resonance for Jews who were facing forced sermons, the Jewish badge, and other attempts to discourage their Judaism. He believed it is our duty to try to understand suffering, and he explores possible causes for why people suffer, ranging from that's the way the world works, to punishment, to it's an opportunity to earn reward. He believes the soul is never fully cut off from God, and that in Olam Haba, in the future, unlike what we said for Maimonides in the beginning of our class at 10, he says the ultimate resurrection is going to be a physical one, but the body will reach the purity of the soul and will be sustained spiritually. Like Moses standing on Mount Sinai, he's still a physical form, but he doesn't need to eat. There's a lot more to be said about all of this. I'm going to pause here. We're going to come back next time to talk about Nachmanides as a Kabbalist, because that deserves a few minutes. And then next time, it'll be, as I said in my email, an extended session. We're going to talk about Abarbanel, and we're not going to cheat Dona Gracia. We're going to talk about Dona Gracia as well. So that'll be next time, God willing. And again, I apologize, but I needed to end early today. And we should have good news. Be well.